UCL with Hiranya Peris, who is my advisor, and I'm going to speak about measuring primordial non-Gaussianity from the properties of quasars, more specifically photometric quasars, and I'll obviously tell you what they are. And if you're interested in the details, this is detailed in these two papers, and this is also done with my office mate, Nina Roth. So we've done this analysis. So before going in the details, I want to give you a little bit of overall motivation for this work. I think we're really lucky these days to have all these super large data sets to actually test cosmological models and specifically very abstract and fundamental ideas. And I think primordial non-Gaussianity is one of them. So obviously I'll remind us what I mean by PNG. But we can do this from the CMB and also from Lashka structure. And frankly, from the CMB side, Planck has set the bar extremely high in terms of standards of data analysis. And I guess one of the ideas I want to show you today is that we're quite far from these standards on the galaxy survey side, which is, you know, there are very deep reasons for this. And one of them is that we have many more observational systematics and complications and effects, which we don't have really good models to deal with them. And so there's a lot of activity and effort to actually try and get these right. And there's a real question today is how are we going to exploit the great potential of surveys like the Dark Energy Survey, Euclid, LSST, and actually all the ideas I'm going to show you today are perfectly applicable to also 21 centimeter surveys and other types of cosmological data sets, which is quite, you know, this is a true question. How are we going to exploit these data sets? So this work that I'm going to present you, it's in line with these ideas, and I'll show you how we've measured the clustering of quasars in a data set which is extremely contaminated, and we had to come up with a robust way to actually mitigate these observational systematics. And then with these robust measurements, we were able to constrain this primordial non-Gaussianity, which is, again, something we really want to do with future surveys. So I'm going to define all the concepts that I'll be speaking about today, but feel free. I know sometimes I have a bit of flow, but feel free to interrupt at any time if I say something which is not clear or if you want to, you know, comment on something. So first, I remind us what I mean by primordial non-Gaussianity and what types of models and concepts we'll try to measure. Then I'll show you why we should look for this thing in photometric quasars. Then finally, I'll show you what we've measured in this data set from this Sloan Digital Sky Survey and what we've measured. And I guess there's a fifth point which is not quite there, which is what about the future? Can we hope to do for future surveys and future data sets in light of these ideas? So, well, first slide, we'd be wrong not to show a picture of the CMB. So thanks, Planck, and thanks, you know, thanks Kendrick, and thanks the Planck team, and for measuring this amazing CMB. And I guess this is a kind of a money plot for many agencies, but in practice, this is more what is observed. And as you know, you have these nice frequency channels from which we estimate the power spectrum of the CMB. And this is already a very compressed amount of data here. Making these maps from the time streams is already challenging. Now, extracting the two-point correlation function from these nice channels with a very complicated foreground model is already challenging. So these are this is more or less a state of the art. And as you know, the polarization results will be released fairly soon. And it's quite remarkable that the Lambda CDM model can be constrained to percent level. And also, this is a two-point correlation function. So since I'll show you some more of these power spectra, I'll describe a little bit what that means. So this is a two-point correlation function in harmonic space. So if you decompose a signal on the sphere in spherical harmonics, which for an orthogonal basis on the sphere, and you look at the power in these coefficients, this is a function of L, of the angular, the harmonic multiple, which low L means large scales, large L mean small scales. And this is assuming azotropy, so it's a, there's a few tricks there. So basically, this power spectrum shows you the Fourier transform of your signal on the sphere. And this works if your field is close to Gaussian. So if the CMB is perfectly Gaussian, then this contains the full amount of information that you have in your data. So we know it's quite true to good approximation, the CMB is quite Gaussian, and this is because we've tested it. So in this case, you can say, well, the power spectrum contains most of the Gaussian information, but also we also need to realize that we can look for other things like specific features, map-based features in the CMB, and for this you need specific techniques which are not quite captured by these two-point correlations. And also, it's fully topical to look for deviations from Gaussianity. And in this case, fairly logically, we need to go to higher order terms. In this case, you cannot just correlate pairs of pixels on the sky, you need to correlate more, so triplets or quadruplets of pixels on the sky. And as you know, I'm sure Kendrick can testify, this is really hard, this is really challenging, intensive, and coming up with models to match with the observation is also very hard. So today, I'll be speaking about primordial non-Gaussianity, which is a window on inflation. So basically, any deviations from Gaussianity in the primordial potential phi, which you can characterize in different ways, will basically appear in these high-order correlations. And one of the most common ones is the local paradigm, which is simply adding a small skewness and kurtosis to this Gaussian potential. And this actually corresponds to squeeze configurations like this. When you couple, when you couple short wavelength modes to long wavelength modes, and so you add this small scale, large scale coupling, and you end up with this type of primordial non-Gaussianity. So this is really interesting because the simplest models of inflation, especially a single field, will actually predict undetectable, extremely small levels of this type of non-Gaussianity. So if you detect it in your data, then you can rule out a really wide range of models, which is extremely interesting from a theoretical point of view. Now, if you don't detect it, then you know it's a different game. And at the moment, I think there was a post-Planck depression because basically Planck hasn't observed any of this local FNL. So as you can see, the local primordial non-Gaussianity measured by Planck is compatible with zero. So something I should also add is that if you measure these correlations in the Planck maps, there are some contributions that we expect from the lambda CDM model, like contributions from point sources or from the ISW, and these correlations will come up in higher order terms. But once you subtract these expected contributions, you would expect to see the primordial part, which so far is compatible with zero. So, you know, it's a little bit of a disappointment for some people, but still we need to push and test for look for this effect in the future. But unfortunately, when you look at the forecast, it's basically close to the final word we can do with the CMB. There will be a little bit of improvement with the next Planck release and maybe with future CMB experiments, but this is fairly close to the full statistical power that we can extract from the CMB, which is, you know, it's a bit of a shame, but fortunately we can actually do much better with the Lasker structure. And this is, you know, there are various ways you can see this, but basically just a mode counting argument will work. There are many more modes in the Lasker structure, and these non-Gaussian initial conditions will propagate and be imprinted in the whole Lasker structure, which is quite interesting. And especially if you want to measure this non-Gaussianity in Lasker structure, we'll actually probe slightly different scales, and you may also be sensitive to different shapes and different physics of inflation in the Lasker structure. So this is why, this is the overall philosophy on why we should look for these effects. Now, there's something extremely interesting when looking for PNG in the Lasker structure, is that these non-Gaussian initial conditions will propagate and actually tilt the halo mass function of your tracers. That means that in practice, we will actually change the way your tracers, your galaxies, your dark matter halos trace the distribution of matter on large scales. And this is extremely interesting because now you have this very great free lunch effect, which is that you don't have to look for high order correlations, these very intensive computations. you can just look at the clustering, at the two-point correlation of your tracers, and you will actually expect to find these signatures. So this is just a toy example where you would look at a population of luminous galaxies, redshift, I think it's redshift 1 approximately, and the fiducial power spectrum is here in red. And now if you add more and more of this primordial local FNL, then you see you will enhance the bias of these tracers, the clustering of these LRGs on large scales. And now the interesting bit here is that this is an extremely specific, a very clean signature. There are not many, well, so far I'm not aware of any cosmological or astrophysical effects which can actually create such a signature. And this is extremely key. Now, I'll try and show you that this is not quite true in practice because there are many problems in the data analysis that can come up with similar effects. But still, from a physical point of view, in theory, this is extremely clean and beautiful. And when you go to the forecasts for future surveys like LSST, you see you can definitely get down to level of one. And actually, this is a very personal comment, but most of these forecasts are very conservative and optimistic at the same time for some things. And I think it's very hard to say what we actually will be able to achieve in practice. And there's certainly a degradation which is due to the very difficult data analysis, but also we may come up with different ways and combining different probes and cosmological data sets to improve this. So I personally have great hopes for measuring FNL in ongoing and future surveys. And this is mostly because of this clean signature. So we're looking for the clustering on large scales. We're trying to measure clustering of tracers, of galaxies, of halos on large scales. Now, this is the current state of these measurements. And this is from a picture from a paper by Tommaso Gianantonio in 2013. And this is just a spoiler for what we've measured. So please ignore this for a minute. Then, so this is just showing you three different data sets, three different tracers from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and also at NVSS, where Tommaso had measured this large scale clustering and constrained this specific signature. So the first thing is you notice is that the error bars are extremely large for LRGs. The second you notice is that these two are biased, especially this one. This is in VSS, so these are radio sources, mostly quasars. And if you combine these naively, which is not so naive, in fact, if you really do a difficult data analysis, but still combine in a naive way, then you find basically detection. You would detect FNL of 50 or 100. Some papers have come up with much more significant detections. And unfortunately, this is not quite true, because when you put your hands in this dirty data sets and you do a very conservative approach, then this detection goes away. And this is because these data sets, it's extremely hard to measure the clustering of tracers on large scales. And I'll show you why. But also the thing which I want you to notice is that the error bars for these two are extremely small, and especially compared to LRGs. And so the measurement that we've done in this work is just using quasars and has these really tiny error bars. And so this is what I want to show you today. It's why we should use quasars and why it's also an interesting case for studying gaps.
Question.
Sure.
Those are also used with the metric quasars, and that was the strongest constraint they had.
It's a very good one, but this paper did better. The one sigma constraints are.
So
in this paper, they don't say they have detection. They say if we naively combine the data sets, and then you get the impression that there's a detection. But when they only keep the cross spectra and the most robust parts, then they don't get a detection. Yes?
What do you mean by the word
conservative? So this is the conservative one is only using the cleanest cross spectra, cross angular power spectra between these data sets. So it's measuring the cross correlation 2-point between quasars and LRGs, or things like this. And yes?
So can we trust it?
How can we test what? Sorry?
Can we trust it?
I think we can trust it, but again, it's very hard. And what I'll show you later on is that all these observational systematics are everywhere. And I think they did a really great job. I think we can trust these two. But this one, which uses the clustering of quasars, cannot be trusted. So we did come up with a technique where you can hope to trust it. And I think for analysis, you can trust the results. But you know, it's still an open question. What about future data sets? So
is your thing is 1 sigma or 2 sigma, the one that you're trying?
This is 2 sigma.
That's 2 sigma.
Right? So it's basically twice. I should have put the numbers, but I didn't want. I'll show the numbers later on. So So first, you may wonder why quasars. Why are they so strong compared to luminous red galaxies, which are already pretty big data sets? Well, the very simple reason: quasars are these active galaxies which are devoured from the inside by their supermassive black hole, which is an extremely violent and which is very, very violent process, and they're extremely bright sources. So when you take a data set like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and put quasars and galaxies on the same plot, then this is what you obtain. Galaxies occupy a very small portion of space, whereas quasars occupy this massive region, this massive volume. So please don't pay attention to these stripes. They're just selection effects for this plot. Obviously, quasars would fill the whole space, but it's just to illustrate for that specific sample how big the volume, how big the volume probe by quasars is. And the second thing is they're really highly biased tracers. So there are astrophysical reasons for this, the type and the masses of halos that they live in and the way these halos evolve. But basically, they're really highly biased tracers, which means that their clustering is much higher than that of halos. When you compare clustering of quasars and clustering of halos, then there's a factor of 10, more or less, between 5 and 10, which is quite strong. And that evolves with redshift. So this is not new. As I said, there was quite a long list of analysis on the market. But most of these analyses are either strongly biased or extremely conservative and throwing out 90% of the data. So they're not competitive. So why is that problematic? Well, quasars look like stars. They're very bright but remote sources, very, very distant sources. So they look like stars. So you have two options. The first one is if you have a spectrograph, then you can definitely distinguish stars and quasars. I'll show you on the next slide why that is. And so if you have the time to actually go and look at each point source in the sky, then you can perfectly distinguish stars from quasars and make a really large survey. And unfortunately, that's not realistic. We cannot do this. That's too time-consuming. Spectrographs are not so sensitive. So it's extremely challenging. So we end up with these spectroscopic surveys, which are small and not so deep. And of course, BOSS, the Baryon Acoustic Oscillation Survey, is quite large. But it's very small compared to surveys like SDSS, which is a photometric survey, where instead of looking at the full spectrum, you look at the integrated light in bands. The problem is that they're large, deep, but they're plagued by systematics. So why is that? Well, if you look at a typical spectrum of a quasar, so the flux density as a function of wavelength, then you see that there are many interesting features in that spectrum, all these emission lines. And you can definitely distinguish it from a star if you have a really good spectrograph. As I said, we're not going to do this. We're going to look at this object in wide frequency bands and integrate the light. So you've only got these five numbers to look at this source. And now it becomes really hard to distinguish stars from quasars. And in fact, it's worse than that. You need to separate stars and quasars and also associate them a redshift. And when you do this exercise on a population where you have both, on known quasars, and you look at you plot the estimated redshift, the photometric redshift, versus the true redshift, then this is what you get, which is really horrible.
What are the two colors on the right?
Different samples. I'm colorblind, so I can't quite. There's red and blue, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
I think it's DR7 and BOSS.
Okay.
So, no, it's 2SLAC and DR7, and I have another one where I've put BOSS as well.
Isn't that your paper? Or, sorry,
that's
not your paper, is it?
That's from one of the papers, yeah.
Your paper?
Yeah.
Okay. But this is your PowerPoint, so you made that figure.
Yeah, I have color codes.
Okay.
That's a different story. But yeah. So you see, this plot is quite horrible. Like, basically, if this was deterministic, if this was easy, then you would have a straight line. And this is obviously far from that. The scatter is extremely large. There's an extremely large fraction of outliers. And they also have some structure, which is exactly what you don't want. That means that you're systematically mistaking lower shift quasars for higher shift and conversely, which is extremely bad. So that means you cannot do a 3D analysis of these quasars. You cannot take these catalogs and assume that you know their 3D positions and do a 3D clustering analysis. What you can do is just like the CMB. You come up with maps which are redshift bins of these quasars, and then you do an angular analysis where you would look at the angular power spectrum, the angular two-point correlation, and compare that to theory. So this is what we did, and we used this XDQSOZ catalog, which is the largest photometric quasar catalog to date. It's from DR8, ZSSDR8. 1.6 million photometric quasars. They're probabilistically selected from colors. So because they're candidates, and probably most of them are actually stars, it's better to do a redshift cut, probability cut, to just keep the objects which are most likely quasars, actual quasars. So we did this very intermediate cut, which is 0.8 in terms of probability of being a quasar, and then divided the sample into four redshift samples with redshift cuts. And of course, because of this process, if you do a cut here, then you will get something which is not localized in that true redshift space. So you've got to estimate the actual distribution of the objects that you've just selected. And this is what we obtain when we apply some methods. So just ask me if you're interested in how we've estimated this. But basically, if you look at one of these samples, so we have four samples. If you look at one, for example, all quasars, all objects between 1.7 and 2.2, then the actual distribution is this yellow-greenish thing. So you see it's quite wider because of these errors. And also there's a secondary peak here because of these structured outliers, which is extremely bad. That's OK. As long as we can characterize these distributions, we can use these quasars and look at their clustering. So we have four samples, four redshift distributions. They're overlapping, which is interesting. That means that there will be cosmological power when you cross-correlate these maps, which is also interesting. And this is where they are on the sky. So this is an equatorial coordinate plot. So you see the galaxy just over there. This is not like the usual CMB plots that you would see. This is actually a plot of the dust in the galaxy and the stars from the galaxy. And you see the black footprint here is showing you the full DR8 footprint. And as you can see, some of these regions are actually very deep in the galactic plane, which is not something we want, because these data cannot be trusted. It's usually for calibration purposes, but it's extremely hard to exploit the objects over there, especially quasars, because they look like stars. So you're actually mostly picking these objects and not actual quasars. So we're going to be using the blue region, which is doing some sanity cuts on the quality of the data, very conservative cuts. And to measure the clustering of these quasars, we'll use the optimal angular clustering estimator, which is a quadratic maximum likelihood estimator, which is going to estimate simultaneously the O2 and cross spectra of these four samples. So we have four samples, four O2 spectra, then six cross spectra. And in case you're familiar with this estimator, you need a model of your pixel-pixel covariance matrix that includes a prior clustering amplitude, which is the power spectrum, and also some knowledge of the noise and the systematics, which is something I'll mention in a minute. So if you're familiar with the CMB literature or with these estimators, you may know that that there's a very big category of estimators which are very common, which are pseudospectrum estimators. And why not use this one here? Well, because pseudospectrum is suboptimal on large scales, and this is because it's not a maximum likelihood estimator when you have when you don't have a flat power spectrum, and this is a tricky issue. And it's actually even worse when you have a very complicated mask and systematics and noise. So this is why we use this optimal estimator for that purpose. Now, what do we expect for these quasars? Before showing you what we've measured, I want to show you how we model what we expect from the Lambda CDM model for these quasars. So, of course, if you assume cosmological parameters, then you can predict what the matter power spectrum is. Then, if you add effects like magnification and use the redshift distribution and redshift space distortions, you can predict what the angular clustering of dark matter halos on the sky for these four samples. Then, on top of this, you need to add things like the shot noise and the bias of these quasars, because as I said, they're not perfectly following halos. The way they form, there's a factor between the clustering of quasars and that of halos. It's the bias. Here, I'll call this the Gaussian bias model because, as I told you before, we expect primordial non-Gaussianity to create a large-scale signature, which is non-Gaussian bias. So, the Gaussian part of the bias has to be redshift dependent, and this is because we're probing quasars between redshift 0 and 4, which is a huge redshift range, and the way they form and evolve in that redshift range means that you need an evolving bias model. And if you add on top of this a signature of primordial non-Gaussianity, then you get this effective bias, which you're going to use to connect your the clustering of halos to the observed clustering of quasars. And this is, I'm just not showing you these horrendous expressions for these terms, but basically, as I've shown you before, this is a K minus 2 scaling for this correction. There is a theoretical motivation. So this is more or less what you would expect if quasars were living in constant mass halos as a function of redshift, which is very well verified observationally. Now, there's no astrophysical reason. We don't know that yet. There's no astrophysical reason why they should live in such halos, but in practice, this is what we observe. So it's a very phenomenological model. But we hope that one day we'll confirm it. So this is the big model. And then we're going to use the MCMT hammer, which is a very nice code to do Monte Carlo Markov chain analysis, to constrain the parameters of this model with the measurements. So I just want to show you what we expect for this sample. So we have four samples with these redshift distributions. And if you just plug in the Lambda CDM model and then fiducial bias values, fiducial a magnification and short noise, and you vary a little bit of FNL between minus 50 and 50, this is what we expect to see in these samples. So you see, this is low redshift, and as you go to higher redshift, you see this signature of FNL, which is much more significant. So I repeat, these are angular power spectra, so large scales on the left and small scales on the right. And as I said, there's cosmological power in the cross spectra because they're overlapping. The redshift distribution are overlapping. Where about exactly?
Upturn for L less than 10 or so.
But is it LS squared CL or is it LCL?
This is LCL.
LCL.
Yeah. This is an artifact of the LCL routine. If you plot this in actual just CL space, you see it's more behaving like the PK plot I've shown before.
I would thought the samples would be shunless down there, that would just go like CL equals constant.
They do. Yeah, that's a good question. So you're worried about the spikes on very low L?
I was just wondering, I would have guessed that at the largest scales, the samples are dominated by Poisson noise and CL, which is a constant.
Yeah.
Because
bias field
is one over K squared.
Yeah. So,
this for non-zero.
Yes, yeah. Oh, okay. The colors are, so there's probably, I'll show the fiducial no FNL. Sorry. So this is why, this is FNL creating this. But you're right, that goes to zero. So, okay, I'll show you, so we try to put data points on this now and see if we can constrain FNL. So let's assume we just take these data sets, these four samples, and measure with this very nice CL estimator, measure the clustering, and put this on this. Then this is what you get. I'm only showing you three of these samples so that we can look at them more closely. So let's take this one, for example. This is this is redshift around 2. And you basically see that there's a significant anomaly on large scale. This is extremely significant. And the color bars, the color plus here show you slightly different masks when we try to, you know, be more conservative, more stringent on the only take the best areas of the sky to measure this. And yet you see it's still very bad. And actually there's no, this is quite anomalous and this is not right. And you may think, well, I've detected FNL, very nice, but it's actually not true because you see some of these effects in the cross spectra. And if you do null test, then you will definitely see that this is due to systematic contamination by other things, which are not cosmological. And so this has been known for a while. There are a few papers in literature about this. And the problem is these effects mimic primordial non-Gaussianity, which is what you're looking for. And that's extremely problematic. So what are these systematics that I keep mentioning? Well, pretty much anything that affects point sources or colors will be considered as a potential source of systematic uncertainties. So for example, dust, extinction by dust, or seeing variations of the sky, or air mass variations, all the zero points, the calibration that you do to your data, if that varies on the sky, then you may actually have some spurious correlations in your data, in your quasar data. And this is actually very significant for quasars, more than for galaxies, because they're point sources, so they're directly impacted by these calibration and by the seeing, for example. So this is just an example of three of these, you know, obvious ones. So stars, dust, and seeing. And you see they have very different distributions on the sky. The stars follow the galactic plane. The dust, to some extent, does, but also there's more structure inside the data. So this is quite problematic. And the seeing, SDSS has this striping strategy. So you have these long stripes on the sky which sometimes have very bad seeing, very bad observing conditions. And this is these things get mixed up and imprinted in your quasar data. And this is what we observe on large scales, these anomalies. So the problem is you can find loads of them. If once you start worrying about these you know, potential sources of contamination and systematics, then you can find literally hundreds of them. Like anything that you use in your processing and your data reduction can be a systematic. And especially for quasars, the number of stars that you use to calibrate your PSF when you measure the PSF of a star or quasar may be a potential source of systematic, and some areas of the sky are worse than others. So, you know, if you try and come up with a full list, then it's very, well, it takes a lot of time. And especially these quantities are extremely hard to retrieve. They're all stored, they're all captured by telescopes, especially by SDSS. But that means you have to go very deep in the data and retrieve them to be able to map them. And the problem is there's a very big risk here. I guarantee you that if I torture my data sufficiently, I will find what I expect. And what do I expect? Well, I know Planck hasn't seen any FNL. So there's a very big risk here that we don't see FNL because we know Planck hasn't observed it. And it's still an open question. Of course, these data, you know, we don't expect FNL to be 200, but still, there's a very big risk, and we don't want to be sensitive to this confirmation observer's bias. And this is why it's so hard. These systematics mimic FNL, and we want to be robust to that. So we had to come up with an approach to deal with them, with all these potential sources, and measure FNL anyway. So suppose you have a bunch of maps, of templates of these systematics, and I've shown you we can come up with hundreds of them. Any of them can be a potential source of contamination. We know we don't want to mask or correct our data because that's very dangerous. It's also insufficient, and it's directly up to you to decide which maps to use and how to correct your data, which is exactly what we don't want to do. What you need to do is to do a clever Bayesian marginalization. We need to come up with a very big model of the contamination and then and do a modal selection and do marginalization of the most which we don't trust. And this has to be done in a blind way, not by hand. So this technique of marginalization can actually be done analytically in the estimator. So that's a little bit of a numerical trick, which has been known in the CMB for a while. It's called mode projection. If you just put in your inverse pixel covariance matrix, your templates with very large weights, then you will actually, thanks to great linear algebra, you will simply project out your templates, which is simply a Bayesian marginalization. Now, what do you do in practice to be robust to confirmation bias? Well, first, you can collect all your potential templates. And for this application, we took 220 templates. Then also all pairs of them, products of pairs of these templates. Because that in that way, you can have a contamination model which is quadratic in your potential sources of systematics, which is a very big model. Now, what you need to do is, obviously, these 20,000 templates, most of them are correlated. I've shown you that there are different categories. Some of them follow the galaxy. Some of them follow the scanning strategy. Some of them are more calibration type systematics. So you can perfectly decorrelate them and come up with a minimal set that can describe your a singular value decomposition. It's just a PCA type analysis where you come up with an optimal representation of your model with these new templates. Now, what you need to do is that each of them is a potential contaminant. It's to run null tests in a blind way. So you have you just set up a machinery to do null tests with your data, and then only project out the modes which fail the null tests. And if you do this, then that means that you're going to be sacrificing some signal in favor of the robustness of your estimator, and this is fully blind, apart from defining what you mean by a null test, which is, in this case, it's just a power spectrum null test that we did, which is
So you're just basically projecting out these modes that you go across.
Yeah.
But aren't you then bound to underestimate the power? Because if you just get rid of a mode, then you have less power.
No, it's like masking. I know it took me some time to convince myself of this, but it's as if your estimator knows, then you've projected out this node. This mode, then there's no risk of underestimating the power. But your estimator must know, which is the case because it's in the covariance matrix here. But it's a very good question. It's basically equivalent to masking. So what we're doing here is a very clever masking, not in pixel space, but in this weighted template space. And so that's unbiased.
Isn't there a little more to it because you're only projecting out the modes that have a significant correlation? If you're projecting out some fixed set of modes,
mm-hmm.
putting them into the covariance matrix, that would just be a linear operation, and it would have some well-defined transfer matrix on the power spectrum. But if you're selecting modes in some nonlinear way based on the correlation for data, then
yeah.
there's some nonlinear function.
But for a given, so it's a very good question, but it's actually an unbiased process because for a given level of contamination. For multiple cosmological realizations, this process will be unbiased. But then, of course, if you consider both varying at the same time, then that does not make sense. You will bias yourself. But here, for a given realization, we're actually estimating the right thing. It's just that you would have to change the usual approach of doing, n-body simulations. And
actually, I had a notice, but so number three, why do you do that, number three?
Number three?
Yeah.
Why? Because that's a lot, and there's no point. Yes, I agree. You could, and we've certainly done that, but there's no reason. Like the null tests are really. So why would you not trust the mode? You would not trust the mode because you find an unexpected correlation between the seeing and your quasar data, which is should not happen. So that's very true, but it's not. I think that does not apply for FNL. You would not expect exactly FNL to follow these templates.
How many of you are you left with? So you said you have 2,700 that targeted modes. How many many of them have class greater than one?
So for the low, this is actually an interesting question. For low redshift and high redshift quasars, you've got heavy contamination by stars. So we project out 500 to 700. The other samples are very clean. You only need a few. And actually, when you examine them, you see that they're typically due to seeing problems or calibration issues, which you would not able, you would not actually pick up if you didn't have this process. But once you project them out, then the samples are clean. So there are very few modes projected for mid redshift quasars. And so this is what we get. I'll just show the high redshift one. This is what we get with this process. So you see, this is before this machinery of blind mitigation of potential systematics and after. So what we've done here is build this template-based model, then project out the templates that failed the null tests. That's all. And then after this process, then you see there's a great agreement between your theory line and your data. And this is not forced by this process. This is an unbiased estimator. So this is a good sign. And especially on large scales, what you see now is that the gray band is showing you what you expect from FNL that varies between minus 50 and 50. And we're sensitive to that. We're definitely sensitive to these levels. And we can definitely discriminate between them. So this is the full likelihood. When you do this extended mode projection on all the data samples, and you see you have this big set of data points and theory lines. It's an angular power spectrum type null test. Okay. So we have the cross 2 point between the template and the data, which is also nice because you can tell exactly where the null test fails and why, on what scales that fails. So I can actually tell you which templates will create what kind of spurious power, which is extremely useful. So this is the full likelihood, and one thing which I do not quite mention on the next slide, I think, is that one thing you can test with this type of likelihood is test whether it's self-consistent or not, which is very useful. You want to see if your high redshift and low redshift quasars are consistent in terms of measured bias or cosmological parameters, which is actually very good for this likelihood. So it's a very good sign that you've done your job properly. And so this is, I think I'm actually showing a plot of bias later on. So this is what we obtain on FNL with this full likelihood. So the gray band here is showing you Planck. And as you can see, this is a bunch of data points from different settings when using this likelihood. We're not quite competitive, but still we're actually beating WMAP9, which is quite remarkable with this old, very contaminated data set. And this is with a single large constructor tracer. Because the signature is so clean on large scales, once you get rid of the systematics, and so these data points show you slightly different settings, and this is quite nice. You can play with the bias model. You can marginalize over different things. You can, for example, this one, which is the more conservative, you marginalize over the cosmology, but also the redshift distributions. You don't want your characterization of the redshift distributions of these quasars to affect your results on FNL, and you can perfectly do this. And marginalizing also over the biased model gives you these two sigma constraints on FNL. And I think the previous one from Gian Antonio, which are, so LRGs plus NVSS plus quasars plus WMAP plus a bunch of other things, is slightly larger than that. So this is just for FNL. Now, as I said, one cross-check that you can do is look at the bias. What's the bias that's coming out of this likelihood analysis? Well, this is the gray band here shows you the full biased model that's constrained for these quasars. And you can also decouple the different parts of the likelihood and say, well, is this self-consistent or not? And this actually is very well within one, two sigmas. And you can go into more details and test this if necessary. So one other thing which is quite nice is that, of course, we can look for GNL. And as you know, GNL has not been done for Planck yet. I know it's going to change fairly soon. So I can still put this slide and say there are no competitive GNL constraints. So The reason this is interesting is because it's very hard to do GNL from the CMB. And again, we're using most of the statistical power. And GNL is a huge scope for doing GNL from large case structure in the future. And this is interesting. Of course, it's degenerate with FNL. As you saw before, it leaves exactly the same signature. But this is not true when you use multiple tracers and combined probes. So there's a huge scope for doing FNL and GNL with large case structure. And so when you do this joint thing, you see they're degenerate, but still you get very, very nice anti-constraints from just these quasars. Now, something else you can do, which is of theoretical interest, because some models of inflation will actually give this type of signature, is to look at this generalized bias, where you would actually, for a given amount of primordial non-Gaussianity, you will say, I will let the signature on the bias be free and be scale dependent. So the K minus 2 signature is now more scale dependent. And you can say, is there evidence for a deviation from that or not? And you see the case that we had before, the normal FNL case, is this axis there. And as you change the signature, then you have these constraints. And actually, there are analytical forms for these Monte Carlo chains here, which can be used to constrain models, especially these ones. So now, the final thing I want to say is, what about future surveys? What are the implications of this type of work for future surveys? Well, I think no one will argue with me that when you look at forecasts for surveys, they're extremely optimistic. And they neglect loads of things which actually hurt in practice, especially all these systematics and marginalization, which I've mentioned. This is extremely difficult in practice. So we did this exercise, taking an LSST-like survey, following the blue book of LSST, and saying, okay, let's do this forecast. And if you do a fiducial MSCDM and no FNL, then of course you get unbiased results and measure FNL equals 0 plus or minus 1, which is excellent. But as soon as you add a few of these real systematics, and I wasn't really mean, I was being quite realistic in the way I've put them in these forecasts, then you get huge biases. Because of course, with so small error bars, you cannot expect to have less than you know, measuring FNL 30 or 50. But now if you apply this same technique, which I've presented you, which is a suspended mode projection, and finding these templates and marginalizing over them, then again, you get unbiased results, and you lose a little bit of power, because of course you're losing modes, but still you get unbiased results. And there's a huge scope for pursuing these techniques in practice and doing this in a blind way. So these are my conclusions. So I've shown you some constraints on primordial non-Gaussianity using quasars. And using this new technique where you can find and handle these potential systematics in a very robust fashion. Now, the future is, of course, some of these surveys, and especially the dark energy survey, where I'm strongly involved. And we're actually pursuing these ideas in the dark energy survey. And I can guarantee you that most of the time we spend is actually on this, because it's not like SDSS. We cannot just read the data and measure something and publish it. This is too precise. DES is too precise to do this. And so we have several different approaches to handle these systematics. And especially, there's a lot of work done in order to map the potential sources of systematics. Then also forward model the full survey, which is an effort which is essential for surveys like LSST and Euclid. And also mapping the actual window function of the survey, which is extremely hard. So what's the probability of detecting a star, a quasar, a galaxy as a function of position of the sky? And this is extremely challenging, but we're hoping that these approaches will converge and give you a nice consistent picture, and that we actually be able to exploit the great potential of DES in the next few years. That's all. Thanks. Any questions?
Is there a bottom line that we're going to be able to improve on FNL equal to 3.7 plus or minus 5.8?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Will you be able to improve?
Yes.
Bottom line.
We will be. And the other bottom line is that I don't know where that's going to happen, when that's going to happen. Because this, we hope to do it for DES, but we don't know if the systematics are going to be really bad or whether we will handle them. But for sure, by LSST, we will improve the Planck results.
The Planck is not going to get
better. A little bit. Just a little bit, I guess. But
10 or 20%.
So.
So just out of curiosity, you know, I opened the LSST blue book. How are systematics typically forecasted?
They're not.
They're not? So that's just the zero systematic.
Yeah.
They
assume some calibration certainty, but this is completely not realistic. There are no spatial, none of the redshift estimation, star galaxy classification issues are spatial dependent, which is extremely hurtful in practice. So there are none of these effects are in the forecast. Yeah.
How robust is that porting what we know about systematics in one survey to design better surveys in the future, for example?
In principle, we should have done it. It wasn't done. But I guess with there's so much activity in this forward modeling of surveys like DS and SST that we will be able to get these effects right one day and use them in the actual design of surveys, which is to me essential, but it's not been done yet. So. Yes.
So I guess I want to get back to that reduced chi-square business. So let's say that there is no systematic, there is no contamination of these quasars by zero template.
Mm-hmm.
So reduced chi-square then should be an average one, right?
Yeah.
By definition, half of them would be larger than one, half of them would be smaller than one.
Yeah.
And you are, by this prescription, throwing out half of them? I mean, that doesn't make too much sense, but you're already throwing out less than half. So maybe I'm misunderstanding something. You're saying you project out everything with reduced chi square bigger than one, but just purely statistically, even if there is no contamination, half reduced. So, but you throw out less than half. So,
what's going on?
Yeah.
Well, we're being extremely conservative, and if we find a correlation between a template and the data, then of course there's no way to know if it's actual statistical fluctuation or due to
but
some actual effect.
Just statistically, 50% of them would have reduced chi-square bigger than one.
Yes.
So, but then you're throwing out only 5%.
But it's a simple masking, right? It's just deciding. It's an objective decision. To throw out part of the data, for example, throwing out
but
some stripes.
You should be throwing out more than that. You said you throw out 500 or something.
Oh, yes, I see. But the templates are not random. I think on average, the chi square is not going to be one. For,
it's not on average.
No.
I mean, you would expect it to be on average bigger than one because there is actual correlation. But even if there was absolutely no correlation, these were completely random templates, you would expect reduced chi-square to be on average one. But
yeah. Yes. That's true. I have the plot, so we can look at them.
Is it really one, or is it larger than one? Your threshold.
So yeah, on average, they're one. Yes.
Okay, and you tried everything above one.
Yeah. And so one thing you.
Okay, so the one on the lower right, that makes for those are obviously.
So these two are clean. These two are very contaminated.
Right. Okay, and then the bin 2 and bin 3 seem more unclear, more like random correlation.
Yeah.
Because that's an average one. But still, you try everything above one.
You do. But what you can do, so we did this game in a very blind way. We decided beforehand, we had this technique tested. Then we decided beforehand what to do. So we had three masks. We had this big set of templates. Then we decided to do three cuts, which is chi-square of 1, 2, and 3. And the bottom line of this is you want to show that your technique is robust to that. And if I could do the same talk with chi-square of 2, I would get similar results.
You've done that.
Yeah. I'm showing one because that's something, you know, people can relate more easily, but it's chi-square of 2 does not change any of the results.
I guess my worry is that you're throwing out power just by because you're throwing out everything that has larger chi-square.
We are, and this is because this data set was really not optimized at all for clustering studies. If I had to redo a quasar sample, I would do it in a different way, and I'm sure I could relax this cut and use much more of the data. But it's also part of the game. We wanted to use this completely suboptimal data set and show that you can do this. Because then you can extend this to galaxies where it's much easier, and you can do chi-square of 3 and 4 and perfectly do this. So.
Well, I would have been much more confident if you tried everything. Again, project that all the time to 700.
So we've done that, but it's a lot of power loss. So you know, the game we wanted to play is do this in a very, you know, blind way and decide everything in advance. But then, of course, we're throwing out a lot of data.
I was wondering, just out of curiosity, how much better this is square NL would be for some quasars if you didn't have to project out any systematic
work. Ooh, well, it's almost a million quasars, right? So if you basically, this is what we obtain with the full sample, right? You take these red error bars. So it's 50% better. It's the constraining power is a lot better. But of course, you get these crazy anomalies. So if the sample was perfectly clean, then you would get this, presumably, you would get this here. And so it's a good question. I suspect we could get FNL to plus or minus 10. But there's no hope, so. So we actually need to compare these.
I think it's the
these
two.
So gray. Sorry?
I'm saying you should look at the error bars there. I mean, the error bar then doesn't translate to error bar FNL because it's very non-Gaussian. So don't call that FNL square.
I agree. That's a really important thing, which, you know, we could have a talk on how to get the error bars right with FNL. So it's also a different game. Yes?
I just wanted to pursue my question. To really test inflation, we need three numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Ratio, tensor, scalar, fluctuation. The tilt, the tensor, tilt, and non-Gaussian.
Yeah.
So when you say that you can improve on FNL over a Planck,
mm-hmm.
how much can you improve?
So this I don't know, because as I said, the forecasts are not realistic with these effects. So I cannot say in advance what we will be able to achieve. So in theory, as I said, in theory with SDSS, we should have done plus or minus maybe 10 or 15, and we're not matching that because of these effects. LSST, the forecast is 1. FNL, error bars of FNL on FNL, the order of 1. But that neglects any of the data analysis issues. And it's also neglecting the joint statistical power, the synergies with cosmic shear and lensing and other things. So we cannot predict that, so which is a shame. Surprise.
Are you making sense planning to make your systematic associated stone maps public? This would be really.
You're not the first one to ask this. I could. I guess I could. I have thousands, so I could put them. But for the interesting bit is that for DES, we've done this work, and we will release maps of the potential sources of uncertainties and calibration errors. This has become something which we want to release, because there was so much time wasted by several groups to just reproduce these maps for Sloan that there's no point. Are we doing this for the survey, so we're releasing them? We're releasing code, and we're going to release that next year. So,
right there.
But for Sloan, I guess I could. If you want, I can release them. I mean, there's not a secret.
They can release it to you.
Any more questions for Boris? Wait a second.